Now, for the reading tonight, we're looking at Genesis 37, Genesis 37 from verse 12 right through to the end of the chapter. And it's a great introduction to a dramatic story, and we look forward to Joe Clifton's presentation tonight. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you very much, Jeff, and welcome everyone to tonight's class, and also welcome to those that are online. Now, Millie just said to me, it says Joseph up there, you're doing the class and it's your name. And I said, yeah, you're right. And I have to admit that I did have a bit of a chuckle when I got given this subject. I don't know what the committee was trying to say, because I'm pretty well aware of some of the bad choices and decisions I've made. But we won't be going into those tonight. We're looking at Joseph from the Bible. But it did get me thinking about a book that I read, and it really did help me with choices and decisions. And the book that I read, I was actually put onto by our brother Peter Johnson. And at the time when he mentioned it, I didn't know that it was by a Christian writer, but one section of it did actually stand out to me. I've just put that excerpt on the slide here. You can see the book there in the bottom right-hand corner. It's called Transforming Your Life from Good to Great, Daily Nuggets of Wisdom by Willie Spears. Does anyone know this book? You know the book? Yeah. Pizza gave it to you? Yeah. Well, he mentioned it and I actually bought it, but it's a very good book. It's if you don't normally read books, it's one where it's got a month's worth of advice, and you read a bit of advice each day during the week in the morning, and then you put it into the practice in the weekend, and he tries to get you to instill some good habits in your life, and it deals with everything in life through that month that you actually read the book. But a line that he said in there, he said, "There are things in the Bible that I do not understand and other things that I do not agree with. However, I made a decision to use it as a guide for my life. So whenever a tough situation comes up, I can go to the Bible for the answer. If I decide to make a decision that is contrary to what the Bible teaches, I know that I am wrong. I don't have to ask myself if my behaviour or action is right or wrong. I know that I've made a decision to do the wrong thing." And how this actually resonated with me was that Joseph, obviously, early on in his life, made this commitment to use God's way as a guide for his life. So thanks, Pete, for putting me onto that book. And it also got me thinking about another declaration that was made where a person had declared that he would dedicate his life to God. And that was in Joshua chapter 24. And I'm sure you know this section well, where Joshua says to all the people at the end of that book, "If it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve." And he's addressing all the tribes of Israel. "Whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." And that clear declaration there at the end resonated with me with the character of Joseph. And I was speaking about this a few weeks ago to Ben Pitcher after Sunday morning exhortation. And he said, well, there's a link with Joshua in that verse and Joseph. And I didn't actually know what that was, but he sent me down a rabbit hole. And I want to explore a bit of that tonight. Also going to look at the character of Joseph, just some lessons that I got out of the study because I've really enjoyed it. And then at the end, we've got a little bit of time, but knowing me, I normally run over time. I've got some slides that show evidence that Joseph was actually in Egypt, which are quite interesting. So we'll see how we go if we get to those. So this declaration that Joshua made in front of the people of Israel was actually made at Shechem, and you might have picked up on Shechem in the reading tonight. It says there in Joshua, this is in verse 1 of that chapter, "And Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders of Israel and for their heads and for their judges and for their officers, and they presented themselves before God." And as I said, Joshua made this public declaration about where he stood. And I've just got a picture there to get you an idea of the scene when Joshua made this declaration before all the tribes of Israel. And it was right at the end of the book in the last chapter. And it just so happens that the people, after he made that declaration, said, "And the people answered and said, God forbid that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods." And then jumping down into verse 21, it says, "And the people said unto Joshua, Nay, but we will serve the Lord. And Joshua said unto the people, Ye are witness against yourselves that ye have chosen you, the Lord, to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses. And it says there, so Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and set them a statue and an ordinance in Shechem. Now, the way that the NIV actually translates that verse 25 is, on that day, Joshua made a covenant for the people, and there at Shechem, he reaffirmed for them decrees and laws. And it says later on, in verses 26 and 27, that he erected a stone memorial in Shechem as part of this declaration that he had actually made as a memorial. But what was Joshua actually reaffirming there at Shechem? What were these decrees and laws? This very same commitment that Joseph made in his life to serve God. Well, if we go back earlier in Genesis, when Abraham entered into the Holy Land, the first place he actually stopped at was this place of Shechem, where God appeared to him and promised to him that he would be given the land and his descendants. And this was the first time that God had informed Abraham of what his ultimate intention was. And he also built there an altar, a declaration of his commitment to God, just like Joshua was repeating much later on when they came back into the land. And we know this section well, so I'll just skip through it. But at the start it says, the Lord said unto Abraham, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee. And there in verse 6 it says, it was the place of Shechem or Shechem. And in verse 7 it says, and the Lord appeared unto Abraham and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord, whom appeared unto him. So that stone monument, that altar, like Joshua erected much later on. So you'll see on the slide there that Shechem is between the mountains of Ebal and Gerizim. And you saw in that picture before Joshua giving that declaration with the people up on the mountains. And it's about 40 miles north of Jerusalem. And it was where Abraham first entered the land. If we look at Shechem now, this is looking west. You've got Mount Gerizim on the left and Mount Ebal on the right, that way around. And there's a narrow pass where ancient Shechem is located. And the city is now called Nablus. Now, interestingly enough, two generations later, after Abraham had been there and put this stone monument up, this altar, Jacob, when he was returning from Padan Aram, went to Shechem as well. And he purchased a piece of land there that was on the perimeter of the town. So jumping across now to Genesis 33, and we're working our way towards Genesis 37, where our reading was tonight. And it says, Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he had came from Padan Aram and pitched his tent before the city. And he brought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father. So there was actually a person there called Shechem as well, for 100 pieces of money. And it says there, he erected an altar and called it El Elohi Israel, which means the strength of mighty ones, of the prince of the mighty ones. So we can see here that Jacob, in this place, also erected an altar and declared his commitment to God at Shechem, following that trend that was set by Abraham and then obviously picked up later by Joshua. Now it says in Acts 7 verse 16 that Abraham actually purchased land in Shechem, and it would actually appear that Jacob was, a couple of generations later, reacquiring that same land, and you can imagine that that monument of stone was put actually on the same place. So very interesting seeing that tie of Shechem. Now, a couple of chapters later, in Genesis 35, Jacob is at Bethel, which is about 20 kilometres from Shechem, where he had done that commitment and built the altar and reconfirmed his commitment to God. Now, it says there, and God said unto Jacob, arise and go to Bethel and dwell there and make an altar unto God. So he's going to go to another place now and make an altar. That appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau, thy brother. Then Jacob said unto his household and all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. And let us arise and go to Bethel, And I will make there an altar unto God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went. And Jacob gave, and they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all the earrings which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak which was in Shechem. So even though they were in Bethel, he took these earrings and strange gods and went and buried them in Shechem, where that original commitment was actually made, and said that their allegiance was actually with God. And Joshua, in that chapter 24 that we looked at earlier, he actually asked the people to put away strange gods that were actually among them, copying what Jacob had actually done in that place of Shechem. So it's quite interesting to see that tie, but it's very important to see that he took that gold earrings and gods and actually buried them in Shechem. So you'll see there on the map that you've got Jerusalem, and they were at Bethel, where they built this altar, but they travelled that 20 kilometres up to Shechem and buried that gold and earrings and strange gods. And you might think, well, what's this got to do with Joseph and decisions? And that's where we're getting, that was Genesis 35, so we're getting through to Genesis 37 now, which is our reading. And we will see that from this slide, that Jacob actually sent his sons north from Bethel to actually shepherd the flock in Shechem. And the context of this was that Joseph was much loved by his father Jacob. He'd had the multicoloured coat. He'd had the dreams, and he'd revealed that the brothers were going to, and his father, were actually going to bow down to him. And the older brothers had been sent off with the sheep to Shechem. And then we find that they'd been gone away for quite a while. Jacob was actually concerned, and he sends Joseph up to Shechem to find them. And you've got to wonder if Jacob actually sent the sons up to Shechem to confirm that commitment was actually around that place, because they had that land there that he'd bought, that Abraham had bought, the stone monument was there. And maybe he was hoping that if they went up there and associated with that place, they would commit their lives to God as well, just as Joseph had already done as a young person. So it says there, as we read tonight, in chapter 37, verse 12, and his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem on that land that he had. And Israel said unto Joseph, do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send thee unto them. And he said to him, here am I. And he said to him, go, I pray thee, see whether it be well with thy brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he went out of the vale of Hebron, travelled north, and came to Shechem. And a certain man found him, and behold, wandering in the field, the man asked him, saying, what seekest thou? And he said, I seek my brethren, tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks. So you could imagine him wandering around on his father's land looking for his brothers, but they weren't actually there. And the man said, they've departed hence, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. So now if we remember this place of Shechem, where Jacob had earlier had gold buried, which the earrings and the strange gods, could it be possible that the brothers went up to Shechem, and rather than staying there and shepherding the flock, they actually dug up this gold and went on to Dothan, a trading place, and actually spent that? Now, there's nothing to corroborate this. It's just an idea, but it fits later with some of the tests that Joseph put on the brethren later with the money that was actually in their sacks. But it could have been quite possible that they dug that up. And the reason why their hatred burned was because the brother Joseph was going to find out what they'd done. That commitment at that place wasn't to God, but instead they dug up the gold and gone up to this trading city of Dothan to have a good time. I can't be factual about that, but it's an interesting idea if you look at that connection with Shechem. But it does seem strange to me that their hatred was so bad for Joseph and their resentment for him was so strong, just because his father loved him, that from an early age he'd been committed to God. And there's obviously many types of Jesus here. Now, the brothers had gone twice as far as Jacob had actually sent them. They'd gone from Shechem further north. And it's sort of in type that they were putting distance between themselves and that commitment with God that was actually at this place of Shechem. They'd gone away from that and had actually gone further. So I don't know what you think of that idea, but it's very interesting if they actually did dig those things up at this place. In complete contrast to what Shechem actually stood for, which we've looked in that history. Now, their plans came from within their own minds, and they were driven, obviously, by that hatred of Joseph. And it resonated here, the decision that these brothers had made, with what John Eakin said in the exhortation on Sunday about the characteristics of the flesh in Galatians 5, versus the fruit that had to be worked on, the fruit of the Spirit. And you can see the fruit of the Spirit clearly there in Joseph and the enmity with the brothers having that works of the flesh. And it just got me thinking of this quote in James 1. It talks that the temptations comes from within and that God can't tempt man. But they obviously, these brethren, brothers, came up with this idea to actually kill their brother Joseph. So it says, "Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death." And as we read, "And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired to slay him." It is obvious from the record that we read that there was obviously some discontentment above the brothers, an argument about whether they should kill him or not. Some wanted to kill him, but Reuben, the oldest, wanted to keep him alive and get him safely back home. So we read in verse 21 and 22, "And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, Let us not kill him. And Reuben said unto them, Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him of their hands to deliver him to his father." And no doubt that would have been a difficult position for Reuben. It's easy to go along with the flow, but to actually stand up for something that's not right is not always easy when everyone else wants to do the wrong thing. And it should be noted that Reuben did stand up, but obviously the group won out in the end. I've just got a picture there of Joseph in the pit, and you can just imagine the trauma of the situation. He'd gone from the much-loved son who was cared for and be given the multicoloured coat. He'd had dreams and been told that his brethren and father would bow down to him. He'd travelled through that place of Shechem and remembered the commitments that had been made to God, and potentially saw those the stone altar that were actually there, and things were going well. And no doubt he would have liked to have seen his brothers, and he'd gone that extra mile to go and find them in Dothan. And yet here he's cast into this pit, and he probably heard the debate about whether they should kill him or not. So he's had this complete turnaround in his life, and he was only a young person. But he'd made the choice to serve God, and to do that was right. And this obviously influenced all the choices and decisions he made going forward. And it was due to this good character and, I think, conscientiousness that he had now been betrayed by his brothers, because they were a complete opposite to the man that he actually was. This situation and this trauma got me thinking of a guy called Viktor Frankl. So I don't know if you've heard of him, but I'm going to go to him in a minute. I forgot to have this other slide in the next slide. So Genesis 37, we've just got a note here that the Judah said unto his brethren, "What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood?" It was Judah's idea here to sell Joseph to the Ishmaelites. And Judah features again later in the story, as does Reuben. And like I said, the trauma of that situation, we can only imagine how he felt. So it got me thinking of Dr. Viktor Frankl. Has anyone heard of this doctor? Yep. So, well, that's good. So Dr. Viktor Frankl, if you haven't heard of him, was born in Vienna in 1905, and he was a professor of neurology and psychology at the University of Vienna Medical School, and he was put into the concentration camps. And in those camps, he lost his wife, his father, his mother and brother. They all died in the concentration camps, and only he and his sister survived. And it's very interesting to read parts of his book and about him and how he kept going during that awful time that he had. But when he got after the war, when he escaped the camps, he wrote this book, which some of you mentioned, called Man's Search for Meaning, and it was a worldwide bestseller. And in this book, he goes more deeply into ways of thinking that enabled him to survive imprisonment in the concentration camp and to find meaning in life despite the odds. And he's actually not a Christian person, but he did recognise faith and spirituality in people when he was actually in these camps. I've just got a couple of excerpts. It just resonated for me with Joseph's potential mindset and the trauma of the situation that he was in. You've probably all read that already, but he says, "We who lived in the concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way, to choose how they reacted to that situation that they found themselves in. Forces beyond your control can take away everything you possess, except one thing, your freedom to choose how you respond to the situation. The prisoner who had lost faith in the future, his future was doomed. With his loss of belief in the future, he also lost his spiritual hold. He let himself decline and become subject to mental and physical decay." And my favourite quote, and I didn't realise actually, but this quote of Viktor Frankl, he's actually quoting another psychologist in Nietzsche, but he says, "Those who have a why to live can bear almost any how." And this got me thinking of Joseph and how he dealt with these situations that he found himself in right through his life. People often use the circumstances they're in as an excuse to exhibit those works of the flesh that we looked at on Sunday. It's very easy to lie and cheat and steal, especially when you're in a bad circumstance. And we can probably understand people's decline to those evil works of the spirit when they're in those situations. But it's very, very hard in these circumstances to exhibit those fruits of the spirit which need to be worked at. And as Viktor said, these people are few in number, and obviously they're people of great character, like Joseph was. And Joseph's faith and trust, despite his circumstances, was actually in God. So hopefully those quotes resonated with you and the situation Joseph found himself in. And then we know Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, brought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down thither. And it says, "The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him, and he made him overseer over his house and all that he had put under his hand." So Joseph stayed true to that commitment that he had made early in his life to serve God. There's no resentment, and his true character is displayed in the way that he actually acted in service as a slave. And I think that's how people saw that the Lord was with him, because of how he held himself and what his character was and how he dealt with the circumstances which he actually found himself with. And God didn't desert Joseph, but he also didn't take away his slavery. And we know that quote that Paul made much later, "Great gain is godliness with contentment." And you can just imagine Joseph, despite the circumstances he was in, always looking at the best of that opportunity, not being resentful, but being committed to God and maintaining doing the right thing. And that amazing character which he showed, his faithfulness, caused other people to trust him despite the fact that he was a foreigner and a slave, he rose to prominence in his family. And still it says that he was the master of the whole house. And you can imagine that Potiphar, obviously being the captain of the guard, was exposed to a number of different people in different positions, and Joseph rose with his character above all of those. And then we know the situation that he found himself in and how he was wrongly accused with Potiphar's wife. And then if things couldn't get worse, being taken away from your family, being made a slave, he actually ended up in prison. And we can see that there in the slide. And once again, despite his circumstances, his character still shone through in that situation. And a great quote to go with this when thinking about Joseph is from 1 Peter chapter 2, where it says, "For what glory is it if, when ye be buffeted for your faults, ye shall take it patiently? But if, when ye do well and suffer for it," which is Joseph, "ye take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. For even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example, that ye should follow his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judges righteously." And no doubt Joseph's faith was tested. His situation was even worse than what he was in before. And he suffered humbly. And often our natural reaction is to protest our innocence and to seek self-pity. But you can just imagine Joseph not going into that self-pity position, but looking at the prison around him and seeing how he could improve that situation for everyone else, rather than worrying about the circumstance that he was necessarily in. And once again, his character actually shone through. And because of his character, it's recorded, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favour in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison, and whatsoever they did, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made to prosper." So as I said, he didn't complain. He made the most of that situation and had a positive influence on everyone that was around him. No doubt he was trusted because he was consistent in his decisions and the choices that he actually made. Both in Potiphar's house and here. And I've lost my cursor, is it up there? I've got it back. And how Joseph rose to prominence in the prison reminded me of Paul and Silas when they were singing, and how they had a positive influence on the prison and the other prisoners that were there. It was very similar to Joseph having that positive influence. And we know that whilst he was in prison, he interprets the dream of the butler or the cupbearer and the baker, which you can see in the picture there. You're laughing, James. What's the?
I was just thinking the guy on the right is the most handsome.
Yeah, I was thinking there's an uncanny resemblance there, and he's got the same eye makeup as you as well. So. Obviously not your marathon running days anyway, James, up there. So, yep. Now, the cupbearer, or the butler, he was released, and as we know, that the baker, unfortunately, was hanged after his dream was revealed. Now, Joseph, in that circumstance, he still had to endure another 2 years in prison, which we just say in prison, but I think our prisons in Australia today would be luxury compared to an Egyptian prison. It would have been an horrific circumstance, not as nice and clean as that there. And we know that even though it took 2 years before he was brought before Pharaoh, he had a reputation and a character, not only, I think, because he interpreted the dreams, but just because of the person that he actually was. And he was brought before Pharaoh. And we see a picture there of him explaining to Pharaoh the interpretation of his dream. And it reads in Genesis 41, "And Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, 'It's not me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace.'" So when he got there in that situation, he'd been called up, he'd been recommended as this great person that he could interpret dreams. The first thing he wanted to clear up was the fact that it wasn't him, that it was actually God. And he didn't use that audience with Pharaoh to seek vengeance for past wrongs. He didn't complain about the circumstances that he was in. He gave the credit still to God despite his circumstances, which is quite amazing. And Pharaoh told Joseph what the dreams meant and that the famine was actually going to come on the land. And then Pharaoh, it says, appointed him to be his deputy over all of Egypt. And you wouldn't think that that would have just come on the back of an interpretation of a dream, but he must have heard stories about the type of person and character Joseph was. And when he told the interpretation of the dream and it was true, then the Pharaoh realised that all the stories that have heard about him must have been true. And then he appointed him to be deputy over Egypt. So it was more, I think, than just the dream, but what people understood of his character. And it's interesting that then Pharaoh just becomes a figurehead because Joseph was in control of everything. And this got me thinking of the quote from Romans 8. "We know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose." So Joseph was still a slave and he was still in circumstances away from his family, but he continued to exhibit that good character, and obviously it was working together for good for him. I've just got another picture here now to put us in the mindset of Joseph in the story for those 7 years storing up all that grain for the years of famine that were to come. And I just imagine in that situation, if you think about Moses when he built the ark and how he was actually ridiculed because they didn't know the flood was coming, you must have thought there would have been a lot of doubters about Joseph and the storing up of this grain, and yet he remained steadfast in doing it through all that time and was strong in character. What did I say, Mark? Something wrong? Oh, Moses? Yeah. Took the animals in the ark, did he? Yeah, sorry. Well, Noah, you know what I mean. So now we're jumping through to what time do I have to finish up?
We started late.
Oh, you're giving me license. 5 after.
8:35.
Okay, 8:35, yeah? Okay, we've got to get a wriggle on. So we know the story. Jacob actually sends his brothers down to Egypt to get the grain. And you think that Jacob was a bit reserved. He didn't send Benjamin, and maybe he thought that the brothers had potentially had something to do with Joseph's demise. But the other 10 brothers are actually sent down. Now, Joseph recognises them in person, but he doesn't know what their character's like. Had they been on the same journey as him and had their character change from when they'd actually sold him into slavery? So he tests them in relation to their character. And first of all, he accuses them of being spies, and he keeps Simeon and says, "If you're telling me the truth that you're not spies, I'll keep Simeon, you bring Benjamin back, and then I'll release Simeon." And once they'd sold them the corn, he put their money in their sacks. And we've just got a picture there of them when they actually found the money in their sacks. Now, I mentioned to you that earlier that Joseph tested them. And if they did dig up that gold back in Shechem, and I know it's a long stretch, and I saw people shaking their head and eyebrows raising, but wouldn't it be interesting if the first test was to see what they would do with some ill-gotten gain as to how they would actually deal with it? The first thing that Joseph was actually testing them, were they still motivated by that money, and would they sacrifice their brother again for this gold or this silver that was actually in the sack? And when they actually found the money, they were greatly concerned. So it sounds like they had changed a bit because they didn't just seize the opportunity to spend that money. And it says there in verse 21 of chapter 42, "And they said one to another, 'We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us,'" and this was when he was in the pit and sold, "'and we would not hear, therefore this distress has come upon us. So actually feeling guilty. And Reuben, who said, no, let's not kill him, put him in the pit, he said, Reuben answered them, saying, spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and you would not hear it. Therefore, behold, his blood is required. And when we not only make a choice to do something wrong, like we saw in that first slide, something that's contrary to what the Bible says, it remains on our conscience until we acknowledge that choice we've made and actually repent of it. And obviously here it was still on their guilty conscience. The brothers were still concealing what they had done. And we know that the famine was sore in the land, and it came to pass a time when they actually had to go back. And when they actually went back, Judah takes responsibility this time. Judah was the brother that actually initiated the sale. But in this circumstance, he takes responsibility around the situation with Benjamin actually having to go up so that they could free their other brother. And this, once again, shows a change in character of Judah, taking responsibility. When they actually got to Egypt, they actually confessed to Joseph about the money that was in their sacks. So instead of actually taking it and hiding it, when they went back, they said to Joseph, well, we found this money. So that's a change in circumstance if they took that gold from Shechem before. And in verse 23 it says, Joseph said to them, peace be to you, fear not. Your God and the God of your father have given you treasure in your sacks. So after they passed that test, he said, peace be to you. So there's the test of the money that could be connected, as I said, to that buried gold. And obviously here in Joseph forgiving them, there was no sign of resentment from him as to what they had done. And he actually invites them, as we know, to have a meal with him. And there's a picture of it there. And as we know, at that meal, he actually lined them up in order of birth. And he sat them from the firstborn according to their birthright. And it said the men there marvelled one at another as to how he could actually do that. And he was playing with their heads, obviously. They would have thought, who is this man from Egypt? The other interesting thing is that he actually gave Benjamin five times as much as any of the other brothers. And the thing was, back in the early days when Joseph was the favourite, he got more from his father. He got the coat and they were resentful. So here he has another test, giving the younger brother more to see if they are actually still resentful of that situation. But it says that then they drank and were merry with him. So there's another test going back to those old circumstances that Joseph put them through. Well, they probably did that anyway. I think anyone that probably came before him.
They did that later on, didn't they?
They did.
But also, in the kingdom of God, it says that Jacob said, what is this dream that you now is dreaming? Shall I, thy mother, and thy brethren indeed come down and bow down to you? Well, the precious mother was dead.
Okay. Yeah, well, I hadn't picked up that point. So that was from back in Genesis 36, where 35. Yeah.
And also Shechem.
Are you stealing my thunder? Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. All right. I better get there before we're here. So in chapter 44, he commands the sacks get filled with the money, and this time he put the silver cup in the sack's mouth of the youngest. So the test here was now about the life of Benjamin, which was the final stage of the test that Joseph was putting them through. And once they'd been sent away with the corn, this time Joseph sent his servants after them to accuse them. And it says there, and Joseph, he commanded the steward of the house, saying, fill the men's sacks, put the silver cup in the youngest, which he did. And then he said, then they went down and accused them. And they said unto him, wherefore saith my lord these words? God forbid that thy servants should do according to this thing. And they said at the end, whoever's done it, let him die, and we also will be my lord's bondmen. And you can see the situation here with Benjamin quite young and them finding that silver goblet in his sack. So this test, rather than being about the items of work value, was about Benjamin. You can obviously imagine their horror. We'd already seen that they'd had a change in heart and they had a guilty conscience, and here they would have just been in distress in relation to Joseph, and having seen the effect that his death had had on Jacob, what Benjamin's death would actually have on their father. So they actually were taken back to Egypt in front of Joseph. And Joseph then again went and searched all the sacks, and he did it in order, like he messed with their heads before. He was doing it in order this time, and they would have seen it go down, and they knew it was Benjamin. And he says at the end, "Wot ye not that such a man as I can divine?" So he was telling them, "I know who you are in order, and I probably know what you've done, what you're covering up." You know, he's saying that I can divine. So that would have got them further agitated. And then, as I said, Judah, who was taking responsibility before, came near unto him and said, "O Lord, let thy servant, I pray thee, speak a word in my Lord's ear, and let not thine anger burn against thy servant, for thou art even as Pharaoh." And then there's an impassioned plea from Judah. He was a changed man. He was exhibiting a character like Joseph, trusting in God, which Joseph had done from an early age. And he'd made a choice, obviously, to trust in God. He says, "And now, therefore, I pray thee, let thy servant abide instead of the lad, a bondman, to my Lord, and let the lad go." And then they were obviously worried about what would happen to their father, and they'd passed that final test that Joseph had actually set for them. Yes, and instigated the sale, so he might have been the ringleader. Now here we see in a situation where Joseph reveals himself, and reconciliation is made here. Now reconciliation is made when you have a character like Joseph who is able to forgive and forget and not hold resentment. So it does take a person in a situation for reconciliation to not hold resentment. But there was also that journey of the brothers who were changed people. And you can imagine that they talked about the reasons why they did what they did, what they'd actually learned from it, and how they were going to try to make sure they didn't do those things again, and that they hoped that Joseph would give them another chance, and then the reconciliation could actually happen. Now, it says there, and I've underlined it, that they were troubled at his presence, and I think that's one of the greatest understatements in the Bible. You can just imagine what they would have thought. So I've underlined that there. Yep.
Jesus reveals himself to the Jews in Zechariah 12. Look on him.
Pierced. Yep. 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 And he says, "Be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life." So not only was he not resentful and he was able to forgive them, but he also saw God at work in his life and why he had actually been sent into Egypt, despite being a foreigner in this land, losing his family, being made a slave and being made a prisoner. He still saw God at work in that journey that he'd been on.